The place that the artifacts have their most information potential is right where they're found.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Elodie Edwards, and I'm back filling in for Micah. This is part two of a two-part archaeological and fossil series. In part one, we heard about how archaeologists are trying to track down the remaining pieces of a mammoth found in Wyoming, plus why archaeologists play a role in fighting wildfires. This time, archaeologists are in a hurry to document some mysterious trees before time runs out on them. Also, how a 50-million-year-old fossil found in Wyoming could help explain the origin of a mammal native to Africa and southern Asia. We start with melting ice patches. The warming climate isn't only melting glaciers, but it's also melting what were considered permanent ice patches located high atop mountains. Trapped safely inside that ice are artifacts of people who lived in these high elevations for thousands of years. Now those incredibly fragile artifacts are melting out. I joined one archaeologist racing time to learn what he can about these prehistoric alpine peoples before all the clues are gone. We drive for hours on a terrible dirt road to reach the ice patch, but Colorado State University archaeology professor emeritus Larry Todd says, heck, this is nothing.
The logistics of getting in to study some of these is not difficult. Today we'll be able to get in the truck and drive for an hour and a half to an ice patch, and that's about as close as we can get. More often it's go to the trailhead, load up the horses and the pack mules, and ride for 6 or 8 hours till you get into the area where you start studying them.
Todd's been meaning to get up to this ice patch for a while now, but with summers getting hotter and hotter, it's hard to keep up.
Things are disappearing, deteriorating, being stolen very rapidly.
High above timberline, we park the truck and climb out. I can't tell you exactly where we are because of the risk of artifact hunters raiding this site. But I can tell you this much. It's to an area where Todd says over 180,000 artifacts have been found in 388 sites. He shows me the way off the ridge to an ice patch.
We're coming up over the edge of a ridge that snow blows over and drifts down below us here all winter long. And it's these relatively permanent ice patches that can contain some of the perishable materials, the organic artifacts, the bones, the hide, the dung. It's sort of an ecological archive in lots of ways.
Todd says ice patches are an oasis on the alpine landscape, a water source for thirsty wildlife and people. We hike down to the base of the ice where a trough has melted out, a good place to look for artifacts. As we pace the edge of the ice, Todd points out a dark layer in it.
A lot of that's going to be organic material. Some of that is going to be animal dung. And so each one of those layers of animal dung, you can radiocarbon date, you can look at the plant contents, you can look at the species.
So, and as it's melting down, then those are getting exposed.
Right.
And washing away.
Right.
And then that layer is basically
lost. It's gone,
lost.
Yeah.
But it's not the poop so much as the people who hunted those animals that Todd is interested in. It was only a few years ago that archaeologists started finding proof that prehistoric people had been living above timberline for over 10,000 years, the remnants of whole villages above 11,000 feet.
This is a harsh environment to live in. We're above the 2,500-meter range, which is referred to as the hypoxia zone, above which humans just biologically, in general, aren't adapted to live at. It's stressful for you to be at this elevation. It requires more calories. It requires different sorts of oxygen use.
The mystery Todd and his colleagues are trying to solve, though, is how did they survive up here? Basket fibers, bison teeth, we now have the technology to glean answers from these tidbits. We continue our search for artifacts around the ice patch's pond, finding a mountain goat wrist bone and some stone tool flex. Todd tells me to watch for wood, a rare commodity up here that means people probably brought it here as a dart shaft or bow. Finding that wood after it washes out, though, is critical.
They're water saturated. So one of the problems is drying them slowly enough to where they don't just explode as they dry out. But you can't just pick it up and take it home and put it on your shelf because you come back to it and you've got a little bunch of wood fragments.
Todd says that's why people who find such artifacts shouldn't take them home. They should leave them right where they are and report the finding to an archaeologist.
The place that the artifacts have their most information potential is right where they're found.
Todd says even archaeologists practice catch and release, mapping artifacts precisely where they find them, then leaving them be.
You can be completely alone in the wilderness, and if you have the eyes for it, you can realize you're part of a socially connected landscape that's been there for millennia.
Leaving them for the next guy shows respect not only for the history record, but also to contemporary Native Americans. When we take artifacts,
we not only erase them personally and their ancestors from the landscape, but then we start erasing their presence.
And to be finding out all of this about these people living up at this high elevation at the same time as it's melting
going away.
It's
I can go from being ecstatic to thinking I need grief counseling within the same day of, look at all this, isn't this amazing? But we can't protect it. It's going away. It's lost. It's gone. You get almost speechlessly excited about, look at this, look at this, look at the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And then that, but how do we protect it?
The best protection is to leave the artifacts in the ice. But with no easy solution to climate change, Todd says he plans to keep spending his summers at the foot of ice patches as long as he can still make the journey. As archaeologists rush to find out what they can about artifacts trapped in ice patches, they're taking a similar approach to ponderosa pine trees that have had their bark peeled off in a special way. The Mountain West News Bureau's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports.
Cassandra Atencio says for tribes like the Southern Ute, these trees are as important as cliff dwellings or stone ruins.
Because we were little and we were nomadic and we weren't like Pueblos and our Navajos. These trees show that we were here.
Atencio is a cultural representative for the Southern Ute Indian tribe. These special ponderosa pines are scattered across the Mountain West, and they all have something in common: a big chunk of bark missing from one side, peeled away by people sometime in the last few hundred years.
This is real. It places our footprint on the landscape as Ute people, as a tribe.
There are a bunch of them here on the edge of a meadow south of the San Juan Mountains.
That is a humdinger right there.
Archaeologist Mark Mitchell walks up to a gnarled tree about as wide across as two people. Its thick red bark is curling in to reclaim an exposed area that looks a lot like a telephone pole.
We're looking at a place where in the past Native peoples have removed the outer bark.
He says they did it to get to a spongy white material inside called phloem.
Some people describe it as a little astringent. I think it tastes kind of coconutty.
Mitchell is the research director for a nonprofit archaeology organization called the Paleocultural Research Group. They teamed up with the Forest Service to study trees like this
one. Who's our note taker?
Volunteers start taking measurements and photos. One person starts screwing a hollow pole into the tree, as thin as a drinking straw. This sample will give a date for when the peel happened.
Got it. Perfect.
There are a lot of questions about these peeled trees.
Yes, there are. One of the biggest questions we have is, what precisely was the purpose of the phloem? We know it's edible.
But, he says, were people eating it because it was a delicacy or because they were starving? Or was it medicine or maybe part of a special occasion? Julie Coleman wonders if the trees could reveal patterns about how tribes like the Ute moved across the landscape. She's an archaeologist with the San Juan National Forest.
Yeah. This is a GPS unit. We get point plots on each tree, and then hopefully we'll see a pattern. And, you know, it might show trails and, you know, passageways.
But Mark Mitchell says they're running out of time to study the peeled trees.
We feel like the clock is ticking now. It's been ticking for a while, but we really feel the urgency of it now.
Drought could kill these trees, or an expanding beetle infestation could cripple them with a fungus called blue stain. Or wildfires could erase them.
Some of the big fires that we've had in Colorado in the last 5 or 6 years have taken some of these trees. We know that.
But time could also get them. Some of these trees could be 500 or 600 years old, like this one.
Oh, wow. That is cool. Wow.
That is neat. That is amazing. I was hoping we would find one of these.
For this tree, people didn't just scrape off the edible part. They also pried off 6 planks of wood, presumably to build something, like a traditional cradle board to carry a baby in. That's what it reminded Cassandra Atencio of.
Oh, wow.
Seeing it brought her to tears.
Wow.
Just a couple years ago, she made a cradle board for her grandson.
And I wanted to do his cradle board old school.
She wanted to peel a ponderosa plank for the backboard, but didn't know how. But here was an example right in front of her.
How long has it been since there's been a Ute woman standing here in this spot again? This is really special. And I feel really good.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
A fossil uncovered in 2016 could shed light on the evolution of rhinos and tapir, a kind of tall, furry pig with a long snout. The 50-million-year-old mammal was found on a state-leased quarry in southwest Wyoming's Green River Formation. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports that the fossil is now being prepared for research.
On a bright, cloudless day in southwest Wyoming, Rick Hebden drives over a steep dirt road, one of his quarries. He's a commercial fossil collector.
Well, like I told you what my dad said, it's like digging in the Cracker Jacks looking for the prize.
Hebden steps onto the crater-like formation and points to small black fish imprints on the ground. He explains the Green River Formation used to be covered in lakes. 50 million years ago, Wyoming had a climate like Florida, so he's used to uncovering fish fossils.
99 out of 100 times you're going to find a fish. And then sometimes you get an insect or a leaf, something that gives you a little surprise, you know. But to find the mammals, that's why I said it's crazy rare to even have them out here.
Finding a mammal is so rare because 50 million years ago, mammals were just taking off. They're evolving to become the modern animals we know today. So when Hebden found one, he was excited.
Up in this layer, right there. And that's where this new mammal was found. And it was right here.
He saw well-preserved hooves, a long femur, a tooth, and a mostly put-together rear half. Hebden reached out to a paleontologist who couldn't find a match for the species. But he did find out it might be the largest mammal ever found in the Green River Formation. Hebden's quarry was state-leased. So soon after he found the fossil, it went to the Wyoming State Geological Survey. A paleontologist in North Carolina narrowed down what it could be, finding it was likely a tapir morph, the group that gave rise to modern rhinos and tapirs. Director of University of Wyoming's Geologic Museum, Mark Clements, says that's exciting. This fossil could help answer long-held questions about where tapiomorphs came from.
Which continent was their home is a big question, and there's a lot of debate surrounding it because their fossils are kind of found all over those different continents. And maybe it's a North American origin for either tapirs, rhinos, or tapirs and rhinos based on this fossil.
An advisory board organized a search for a preparator, someone who frees a fossil from the rock. Many, like Hebden, have been anxious for the preparation, to find out just what animal it is. And now that person has been chosen.
My name is Mike Eklund.
Eklund is a specialist located in Illinois. He's just begun preparing the specimen.
The piece that I'm working on today has, according to the x-ray, a very nice articulated leg with all of the foot bones and everything.
He says the bones look almost black and are encased in tan-colored rock. He uses small needles, mini air jackhammers, and hand tools to remove the bone. But he's also been setting up technology to see what the naked eye cannot.
I've been working on using fluorescence illumination and getting images of the specimen before work is begun. But also, I spent a fair bit today getting the time-lapse photography set up.
Time-lapse photography, special lighting, extra magnification, those are all special skills Wyoming Small Advisory Board wanted in a preparator, because it can help Eklund find biological information that might otherwise be lost.
There's a lot more tissues and other things present that get missed very often that we just need to look closer for and have a chance of finding them.
Soft tissue. That's the name of the game here. It's pretty rare, but Eklund and the Geological Survey expect to find it given how well the fossil's been preserved. Soft tissue can shed light on how the animal looked, size of its snout, shape of its ears, or what its diet was. It's not guaranteed to find all that information, of course, but it could
put a better picture together of the environment it was from, as well as the actual biologic details of this mammal.
Eklund is still around 2 months away from fully removing the fossil from its rock surroundings. Once it's prepared, the specimen will be housed within the Wyoming State Geological Survey in Laramie, with the chance to be on loan for display or research elsewhere. Back at the quarry in the Green River Formation, Rick Hebden stands by the site where this special fossil was originally found. He's uncovered crocodiles, bats, and palm leaves in his lifetime of fossil hunting. But he says this is something brand new, and that's exciting, both for him and for science. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Meanwhile, at Florissant Fossil Beds National Monument, there's a vast collection of fossils from a more recent global warming. The Mountain West News Bureau's Ali Budner explains some of the interesting finds.
Florissant Fossil Beds National Monument is nothing fancy when you first drive in. No towering cliffs or dramatic canyons. It's a calm, sunny valley, 6,000 acres all total, of meadow and ponderosa pine forest. It's what blends into the landscape and what's buried under the ground that this park is known for, fossils.
It's an incredible fossil history here.
Whitney Mastin is an interpretive ranger here and my guide for the morning.
We have 1,700 species of plants and insects that have been identified from the Eocene period.
In case you don't know, the Eocene period was over 34 million years ago. For context, the dinosaurs were already long dead by then. And the Earth's temperature? Well, scientists believe the early Eocene was a time of abrupt global warming. Here in Colorado, the climate would have become almost tropical.
So we're finding fossils in our collection of things like tsetse flies, which now live in Africa, ginkgo leaves, which are in Asia.
We start off walking on a gravel path into the meadow.
What we're seeing back here are these huge petrified redwood tree stumps.
We stop to look closer. This sign says redwoods in Colorado, ?
Redwoods in Colorado? It's crazy.
Crazy because redwoods thrive in more temperate, lower elevations, not environments like this one, which sits at about 8,600 feet.
34 million years ago, this place looked very different. The climate was warmer and wetter, and we had these huge towering redwood trees that could have stood 300 feet tall.
The petrified remnants of these giants aren't flashy, but they are impressive. Just the stumps remain, but they alone stand 15 feet high. They're striated with a rainbow of subtle hues, from rusty iron to streaky white to yellows and greens.
And how they became petrified is a story in itself.
Blame it on a series of volcanic eruptions, which occurred just about 15 miles from here.
One of those eruptions was a mud flow that blocked off a creek.
The mud flow encased the base of these massive trees, and then millions of years did their work, turning them into towers of mineral, mostly silica. In the meantime, other fossils were forming. The Florissant Valley flooded and became a giant lake. Algae grew on its surface and was periodically showered with fine volcanic ash from continuing eruptions.
And so what we're left with are these layers and layers and layers and layers of algae and ash and algae and ash and algae and ash.
Between these layers, plants, insects, and fish got trapped and fossilized. Turns out strange things like fish poop and fish vomit also got fossilized. The official name for fossilized fish vomit? Wait for it. Regurgitalite. It's on display at the park's visitor center. Now, there were creatures larger than fish that lived here during the Eocene.
We would have had kind of the beast of the forest, which was this huge brontothere, similar to today's rhinoceros. And he would have stood about 15 feet tall. So, and then another one that I love to tell, especially our school groups about, are the small horses that were once here. And these were called Mesohippus, and they stood just about 24 inches tall.
But most of the fossils scientists have found by cracking open the paper-thin sheets of shale rock from this ancient lake bed are of plants and insects, tiny impressions of leaves or delicate carbon shadows of wasps. One of the most famous of these fossils, Mastin says, is called Podryas Persephone.
Which was a butterfly. And this butterfly was so perfectly preserved that you could see the patterns in its wings, its antennae, its you know, furry little abdomen. I mean, it's a pretty incredible fossil.
The detailed preservation of individual fossils like this and of an entire past ecosystem here has helped geologists and paleontologists get a clearer picture of a time on Earth when global temperatures were changing dramatically, not unlike today. For the Mountain West News Bureau at Florissant Fossil Beds National Monument, I'm Ali Budner.
I'm Melody Edwards. David Graff produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.